We have been talking about the last week of Jesus' ministry leading up to his crucifixion for the last couple of weeks. I want us today, as we're getting ready to really bear down on the night of his betrayal, I want us to see how this week progressed. It actually started on a Sabbath day down in the Jordan Valley. It was the eighth day of the first Jewish month. And when Jesus was threatened with potential harm done to him by Herod the Great, his response was, I have to travel today, tomorrow, and the next day after that, I will arrive at my goal. For no prophet should be dying outside of the Jerusalem area. And by that, he predicted the day he would arrive at Jerusalem. Now, the following day, the ninth day of the first Jewish month, he traveled across the Jordan River, through Jericho, up the hill to the city of Bethany. And then he spent the night there, as was his custom. So that was now starting into the 10th Jewish day of the first Jewish month. Remember that Jewish days run from sunset to sunset. So Jesus had the big meal on the night of his arrival, prepared by Martha. And Martha was all worried about that. And Mary was listening to Jesus. And then Mary anoints Jesus and prepares him for the burial. Remember that Judas Iscariot objected to the use of a year's worth of perfume, a year's worth of wages worth of perfume in that fashion. And John the Apostle tells us, not because he was really caring about the poor, but because he was a thief. So that all happened. That would have been on Sunday night that the meal was. The next morning, which is the 10th day of the first Jewish month, for us it would have been a Monday morning. That is when all of the Passover lambs were supposed to be designated for their use 4 days later. And so Jesus goes into Jerusalem. We have the triumphal entry. He's being welcomed as the Passover lamb. He doesn't do much at Jerusalem that day because it's late in the day when he goes in on his triumphal entry. And then he comes back and spends the night at Bethany again, which brings us then to the 11th day of the first Jewish month. It is now a Tuesday morning, and Jesus is on his way into the temple to teach, and he sees a fig tree that is in leaf and should have had figs on it. It doesn't, so he puts a curse on it. He then cleanses the temple for the second time in his ministry because they're cheating the Passover worshipers. And then at the end of that day, he goes back to Bethany for the evening, which brings us to the 12th day of the first Jewish month. And this is now a Wednesday, and he goes to the Temple Mount as usual. On the way, they see the withered fig tree, and he teaches them a lesson about faith. Through that day, we have a whole bunch of confrontations of leadership with Jesus and a lot of questions that are asked. The Pharisees are after him. The Herodians are after him. The Sadducees are after him. And Jesus answers all of their questions in such a way that they are stymied in their approach of trying to get him in trouble, and instead just making the people even more impressed about Jesus. Until finally, toward the end of the day, as he's leaving, his apostles mention how beautiful and how big all the stones and the buildings are in the temple complex. And Jesus says, you see all these things? Not one of these stones is going to be left upon another. They're all going to be torn down. And of course, that became the reason for Jesus' apostles talking to him on the slopes of the Mount of Olives as he was heading back to Bethany that night. and saying, when's that going to happen? When are these things going to take place? When not one stone is going to be left upon another? And that's the Olivet Discourse that we've spent a week on. And when that was over with, Jesus then went back to Bethany, but his disciple Judas apparently sought out the Sanhedrin, which happened to be meeting that same night to talk about the Jesus problem. Judas was disgruntled by this time, disillusioned as a follower of Jesus by this time. And he decided to go to the council to ask them what it would take for him, what they'd pay him if he were to arrange for them to arrest Jesus more privately. And they'd been hoping for that. Now, they had agreed already at this secret meeting in at the high priest Caiaphas's complex in Jerusalem. They wanted to wait until after the Passover was finished in order to take Jesus out, because they were worried there would be riots. But now, since one of the 12 who knows Jesus' schedule, knows where he's at most times, one of them is now coming to the Sanhedrin to offer a secret arrest opportunity, they think they can get it done quick. And so this has really changed their schedule that they'd originally had in mind. But God has a different schedule. Jesus will die on the day of Passover, at the same time the Passover lambs are being butchered. And we'll talk about more of that symbolism later. And so the last thing we were talking about last session is that after some wrangling back and forth, Judas agrees that 30 shekels is sufficient for him to betray Jesus. That's equivalent of 60 days' wages, because each shekel is 2 days' wage for Jewish standards. And so Judas is now looking for the perfect opportunity to betray Jesus in a private setting. The most obvious place to do that would be Thursday night, when Jesus and his Galilean apostles will meet for their Passover meal. Now, the Jewish people living in Jerusalem, many of them are in the custom that they don't have the Passover until the next evening, because this is the way it worked. The original Passover, the Passover lamb was butchered on the 14th in the late afternoon, and then they started eating it on the 15th whenever the sun went down. And then at midnight, that's when the whole passing over of the death angel took place. And then they left Egypt. Now, the way that the Jewish people do it is anytime on the 14th, they can butcher and cook their Passover lamb, and then eat it thereafter. So some of the Jewish people, apparently the Galileans were in the habit of doing this, they will eat it, they will butcher it as soon as the 14th sunset happens. So they're like one day ahead of the Jewish Judeans, who wait until the late afternoon of the 14th and butcher the lamb. And so this is going to allow Jesus to both eat the Passover meal and be the Passover lamb the next day. Again, I'll explain a little bit better how that symbolism all works out later. But for right now, I want you to get ready to join Jesus and his apostles for their last Passover meal together. First, I want to read from John chapter number 13, John chapter 13, verse 1. Now, before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, He loved them to the end. Now, that's commentary by John the Apostle, who was there, who felt all of the emotion that we're about to spend a couple of sessions on. He says, Jesus loved us all. Jesus was committed to us all. And that commitment meant that he had to die. But before that happened, he wanted to spend one last Passover meal with us. Mark chapter 14, verse number 12. On the first day of unleavened bread, when they sacrificed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, "Where will you have us go and prepare for you to eat the Passover?" So on the Thursday late afternoon, which was technically the 13th, the apostles know that the 14th starts as soon as the sun goes down that night. And that's when they are in the tradition of eating their Passover meal. So they approach Jesus and say, "Jesus, it's almost time. It's time for the Passover lamb. Where do you want us to go and get things ready for you and your apostles to have this Passover meal?" Now, they could have stayed at Bethany. They would have been welcome there, I'm sure. But instead, Jesus wants to have his Passover meal inside the city limits of the holy city. And so he sent two of his disciples and said to them, now these two disciples are picked, because of who they are in the apostle leadership. Luke chapter 22, verse 8 tells us specifically, Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us that we may eat it." So Peter and John are two of the three inner circle. And so Jesus taps them to go and get everything ready. Now, why two? Well, two always are better to be traveling together. But I think the more significant thing is this. The Passover rule was that you needed one lamb for every 10 adult men in your group or any part thereof of 10. So because we've got 12 apostles plus Jesus, that's 13 adult men just as the minimum. They need to have at least two Passover lambs. So Jesus sends two disciples to go get two Passover lambs and to butcher them and then cook them up for the disciples' Passover that night. All right, so verse number 13, we're back in Mark again. Remember, Mark is Peter's remembrances, and he's one of the two guys sent. He sent two of his disciples, said to them, "Go into the city," meaning the city of Jerusalem. Now that tells me immediately Jesus and his disciples didn't bother to come from Bethany to Jerusalem on this day. Because if he had, then he'd be sending his disciples just somewhere else in the city. And that's not the way it's described. So Jesus tells them, "You go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you." It's not that this guy is going to be waiting on them. It's basically, you're going to see this guy, and you need to follow him. In fact, I think at this point, no, we'll go ahead and stay in the Mark one. Mark goes on in his gospel and says, "Go into the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you, follow him. Wherever he enters, say to the master of that house, 'The teacher says, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?'" All right, let's throw some speculation, but I think reasonable speculation in here. Remember that Judas Iscariot has agreed with the Sanhedrin privately that he's going to find a means of letting them know where Jesus will be pretty much alone and away from the crowds so that they can arrest him and start the process of getting him out of circulation. The Passover meal on Thursday night, when Jesus is alone, away from the crowds of the temple, and the crowds are all taking care of their own business elsewhere, that would be the perfect opportunity. Jesus keeps Judas from being able to identify the place of that private meal by not letting any of the disciples know where that's at. He makes a supernatural sign for Peter and John to follow. Go into town, you're going to see a man carrying water on his head. Now that is reasonably unusual. Mostly women carrying water around on their head. Once you see the guy, follow him. He's going to go into a specific house. You're going to go into that house and you're going to ask for the owner. Once you meet with the owner, you're going to say, "Where's the upper room that my master, the Lord, can have his Passover meal with his disciples?" Now, what else does that tell us? That means that the man in that house must have been given some sort of sign by God, perhaps a dream vision, an angelic visitation, telling him to get the upper room ready with everything necessary for a large group of 12 plus adult men to have the Passover meal, have all of the foods ready to go, perhaps even have the lambs there, I don't know, and all the utensils. And when two guys show up to ask you about it, show them it. And so this is all supernatural, and it's all very covert. It's cloak and dagger sort of stuff to keep Judas from knowing where Jesus is going to be during this time of the upper room meal. All right, so verse 15 of Mark 14. He will show you a large upper room furnished and ready. See, that's where I got the idea that most of the foods are there, all the utensils are there. Somebody had to get all that ready and not be planning on using it for themselves, getting it ready for somebody else. So this is the ministry of this unknown person. I'd love to know who he is, that got the upper room ready. So verse 16, the disciples set out. They went to the city. So they did that little trek from Bethany down into the city. The tradition is that it happened somewhere over in the ritzy part of town, the rich part of town, which is the Western Hill. It's today called Mount Zion, but that was not the way it was titled in that time. Mount Zion has always been the Temple Mount. Today it's called Mount Zion because it was accidentally thought to be the place where David's palace was located. What they'd actually seen there was the remnants of Herod's palace. This is the western, and I think the more southwestern part of the old city of Jerusalem today, just south of what's called David's Citadel. Herod's ancient palace. That was the wealthy part of town. It was the upper city. And so a private residence with a large upper room that could be used for a dinner gathering for a good-sized group probably was in that local area of the city. Now, they will show tourists today an upper room. It's very pretty. It's vaulted and all that. But there's no way in the world that's the upper room. And the reason I can say that with authority is because that part of the city was totally destroyed in AD 70. Nothing was left. That room that they show to the tourists as the upper room is actually Muslim time period. And you can even see Muslim decoration throughout the room. But it is somewhere probably fairly close to the traditional site of the upper room house. And so I still like to kind of walk over to that part of the city. So they went there to prepare. And so they found it just as he told them, and they prepared the Passover. Now, what's involved in that? They will wait until the sun goes down, because then the 14th day will start. That's Passover day. They will cut the throats of the two sheep that they have. They will then skin them out, gut them, put them on skewers, and put them over a very hot coal fire, and then kind of rotate them. And so it's a big sheep roast, a big lamb roast that they are cooking. And then all the other accoutrements for the Last Supper are going to be there. Traditionally, it's going to be things like the bitter vegetables, the bitter lettuce and bitter root vegetables that would be available at this time. Maybe some celery, maybe some green onions, something equivalent to endive or romaine lettuce, something of that nature, maybe some chicory. The all of those bitter tastes, because they want to have bitter herbs. They're going to maybe have some other dried things that are from previous years, like the fruits, like figs and dates. They will probably have things such as olives, because those are typically on all these tables. They will have bread. On this particular night, it will be unleavened bread, because this is the first day of unleavened bread and Passover season. And so all of that is now being put together, and it's after the sun has gone down, and Jesus then is going to bring the rest of his disciples there. Mark 14, 17, when it was evening, just like I said, after the sun's gone down, he, meaning Jesus, came with his 12. And so they're now all at the table. Now, in the time that we've got left, I want to set the stage for the next thing that we're going to talk about from John chapter 13. It was traditional when you came to a house that the host of the house, the host of the dinner, would have a servant next to the door as you came in, helping you off with your sandals and washing your feet, probably taking the sandals away to get them all cleaned up for you putting them on again later, and then making sure that you got a hug and a welcome greeting into the room. And then you were escorted to your place at the table, which was based on your position in the rank of the society. The eating took place where you were reclined at the table. You were leaning on your left elbow with your shoulder facing toward the table, at where you could eat with your right hand, and your feet were pointed away from the table. The highest ranking person was the host of the dinner, and he usually was at the center of the main table. And then the next two places of importance would be the person to his back. That would be the number one spot, because he has your back, right? And then in front of the host would be the number two position, and they'd be able to lean back onto the bosom of the host. So it was a special place. So what happens is, when they get to the upper room, there is no servant at the door offering to wash their feet. And so the custom should have been that the lowest rank in the group would volunteer to do that job, to help people off with their sandals and wash their feet. We know that what happened is, as soon as they hit that door, every last apostle failed to volunteer to be the foot servant, and they all scrambled into the different places to show where they ranked. And we know, and I'll explain to you why we know this later, John the apostle got the number two place in front of Jesus, and Judas Iscariot got the number one place behind Jesus.